I spent 2 weeks in July at Camp David working with Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak and PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat and their delegations trying to reach a final peace agreement. Sadly, our efforts ended without result, but we committed to continue the work over the next 6 months. I never really expected to get an agreement at Camp David, and I was gratified that for the first time we had discussed fundamental issues and had narrowed the gaps between the two sides. I still thought there was a fair chance of getting the whole agreement done before I left office. After Camp David, I resumed my battle with the Republicans over tax cuts. Again, they wanted to spend a decade's worth of projected surpluses on them, claiming that the money belonged to the taxpayers and that we should give it back to them. It was a persuasive argument, except for one big thing. The surpluses were projected. The tax cuts would take effect whether they materialized or not. I had a lot of fun with the fight by asking people to imagine that they had got one of those heavily advertised letters from well-known TV personality Ed McMahon that started out, "You may have already won $10 million. I said that the people who would spend $10 million upon receiving that letter should support the Republican plan. Everyone else should stick with us and keep the prosperity going. On August 14th, opening night of the Democratic Convention, Hillary gave a moving expression of thanks to the Democrats for their support and a powerful declaration of what was at stake in this year's election. Then, after my third and final convention film, produced by my friends Harry and Linda Thomason, outlining the accomplishments of the last 8 years, I was brought on stage. When the applause died down, I said that the election was about one simple question. Are we going to keep this progress and prosperity going? I asked the Democrats to make sure we applied President Reagan's 1980 standard for whether a party should continue in office. Are we better off today than we were 8 years ago? The answer proved Harry Truman was right when he said, "If you want to live like a Republican, you'd better vote for the Democrats." The crowd roared. We were better off, and not just economically. Jobs were up, but so were adoptions. The debt was down, but so was teen pregnancy. We were becoming both more diverse and more united. We had built and crossed our bridge to the 21st century. Then I argued for Al Gore, emphasizing his strong convictions, good ideas, understanding of the future, and fundamental decency. And I ended my speech with a personal plea. My friends, 54 years ago this week, I was born in a summer storm to a young widow in a small southern town. America gave me the chance to live my dreams, and I have tried as hard as I knew how to give you a better chance to live yours. Now my hair is a little grayer, my wrinkles are a little deeper, but with the same optimism and hope I brought to the work I loved so 8 years ago, I want you to know my heart is filled with gratitude. My fellow Americans, the future of our country is now in your hands. You must think hard, feel deeply, and choose wisely. Remember, keep putting people first. Keep building those bridges. And don't stop thinking about tomorrow. The Bush-Cheney ticket had settled on a two-pronged campaign message. The positive argument was compassionate conservatism, giving America the same good conditions we had provided with a smaller government and a bigger tax cut. The negative one was that they would elevate the moral tone and end bitter partisanship in Washington. That was, to say the least, disingenuous. I had done everything I knew to reach out to the Republicans in Washington. They had tried to demonize me from day one. Now they seemed to be saying, "We'll stop misbehaving if you give us the White House back." On October 12th, a small boat laden with explosives blew up beside the USS Cole in port in Aden, Yemen. 17 sailors were killed in what was obviously a terrorist attack. We all thought it was the work of bin Laden and al-Qaeda, but we couldn't be sure. The CIA went to work on it, and I sent officials from defense, state, and the FBI to Yemen, where President Ali Saleh had promised to cooperate fully in the investigation and in bringing murderers to justice. Meanwhile, I continued to push the Pentagon and the National Security Team for more options to get bin Laden. We came close to launching another missile strike at him in October, but the CIA recommended that we call it off at the last minute, believing that the evidence of his presence was insufficiently reliable. The Pentagon recommended against putting special forces into Afghanistan, with all the attendant logistical difficulties, unless we had more reliable intelligence on bin Laden's whereabouts. That left bigger military options, a large-scale bombing campaign of all suspected camp sites or a sizable invasion. I thought neither was feasible without a finding of al-Qaeda responsibility for the coal. I was frustrated and hoped that before I left office, we could locate bin Laden for a missile strike. It was not to be. I spent the day before the election and Election Day doing more than 60 radio interviews across the country, urging people to vote for Al and Joe Lieberman and our local candidates. I had already recorded more than 170 radio ads and telephone messages to be dialed in the homes of hardcore Democrats, asking them to vote for our side. Election night was a roller coaster. Hillary won her election against Republican Rick Lazio 55-43%, a much larger margin than she had in all the pre-election polls but one. I was so proud of her. New York had put her through the ringer, just as it had done to me in 1992. She had been up, down, and up again, but she kept her bearings and pressed ahead. As we celebrated her victory at the Grand Hyatt Hotel in New York City, Bush and Gore were neck and neck. Going into Election Day, I still thought Al would win because he had the momentum and he was right on the issues. Gore did win by more than 500,000 votes, but the Electoral College was in doubt. The race came down to Florida after Gore won a narrow victory of 366 votes in New Mexico, one of several states that were closer than they would have been had Green Party candidate Ralph Nader not been on the ballot. Nader also got enough votes in New Hampshire to swing the state to Bush, and had received more than 90,000 votes in Florida. Al was at a disadvantage going into the election recount in Florida because the chief election official, Secretary of State Katherine Harris, was a conservative Republican who was close to Governor Jeb Bush, and the state legislature that would certify the electors was dominated by conservative Republicans. On the other hand, the state Supreme Court, which presumably would have the final say on the counting of ballots, had more judges appointed by Democratic governors and was thought to be less partisan. On December 8th, I traveled to Nebraska, the only state I had not yet visited as president, for a speech at the University of Nebraska at Kearney. It was, in effect, a valedictory address in the heartland, urging continued American leadership in the world. Meanwhile, the Florida Supreme Court had ordered the inclusion of more recounted votes in Palm Beach and Dade counties, and the recount of 45,000 more votes according to the standard of Florida law. The ballots were to be counted if the intent of the voter was clear. Bush's margin was now down to 154 votes. Governor Bush immediately appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court to stop the recount. Several lawyers told me the Supreme Court wouldn't take the case. The mechanics of elections were a question of state law unless they were used to discriminate against a group of citizens like racial minorities. Also, it's difficult to get a court-ordered injunction against an otherwise legal action, like an election recount or raising a building when the owner agrees. To do so, a party must show that irreparable harm would result unless the activity is stopped. In a 5-4 decision, Justice Scalia wrote an astonishingly honest opinion granting the injunction. What was the irreparable harm? Scalia said counting the ballots might, quote, cast a cloud on what Bush claims to be the legitimacy of his election. Well, he was right about that. If Gore got more votes than Bush in Florida, it would be harder for the Supreme Court to give Bush the presidency anyway. We were having a Christmas reception at the White House that night, and I asked every lawyer who came through the receiving line if he or she had ever heard of such a ruling. No one had. The court was to hand down another opinion shortly on the underlying issue of whether the recount itself was constitutional. Now we knew they would kill it by 5-4. That's exactly what they did on the following Monday. It was an appalling decision. A narrow conservative majority that had made a virtual fetish of states' rights had now stripped Florida of a clear state function, the right to recount votes the way it always had. The five justices who didn't want the votes counted by any standard claimed to advance equal protection by depriving thousands of people of their constitutional right to have their votes counted, even if their intent was crystal clear. They said Bush should be awarded the election because the votes couldn't be counted in the next 2 hours, the deadline under Florida law, when, after already killing 3 days of the recounting with their injunction, they had delayed issuing their own opinion until 10 o'clock at night to make absolutely sure it couldn't be completed on time. The 5-vote majority didn't make any bones about what it was up to. The opinion clearly stated that the ruling could not be used as precedent in future election law cases. Its reasoning, quote, was limited to the present circumstances, for the problem of equal protection in election processes generally presents many complexities. If Gore had been ahead in the vote count and Bush behind, there's not a doubt in my mind that the same Supreme Court would have voted 9-0 to count the votes, and I would have supported the decision. Bush v. Gore will go down in history as one of the worst decisions the Supreme Court ever made, along with the Dred Scott case saying that a slave who escaped to freedom was still a piece of property to be returned to its owner. Plessy v. Ferguson upholding the legality of racial segregation. The cases in the 20s and 30s. Invalidating legislative protections for workers like minimum wage and maximum workweek laws, as violations of property rights of employers, and the Korematsu case, in which the Supreme Court approved the blanket internment of Japanese Americans in camps after Pearl Harbor. We had lived through and rejected the premises of all those previous reactionary decisions. I knew America would also get beyond this dark day, when five Republican justices stripped thousands of their fellow Americans of their votes, just because they could. Al Gore gave a marvelous concession speech. It was genuine, gracious, and patriotic. When I called to congratulate him, he told me that a friend of his, who was a professional comedian, had joked that he had gotten the best of both worlds. He had won the popular vote and didn't have to do the job.